Canadian investors are using ZSP over any other ETF for exposure to the S&P 500 index. Institutional investors, investment advisors, and DIY investors have all been trusting ZSP with their investment dollars since the fall of 2012. ETFs provide instant access to a portfolio of stocks to an investor in a single cost-efficient trade. For an investor to own the entire index would require institutional-level trading systems and expertise. To accomplish this, an investor would have to buy 500 stocks at a time, and then as the market moves, it would constantly have to rebalance those 500 stocks several times a year. ZSP simplifies this process by aiming to provide instant access to the 500 stocks in the index in a very easy and low-cost way.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to the Looney Hour, episode 133. As always, joined by the three amigos, Boomer, Keith Dicker, IceCap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM Global. What's going on?
Hey, I'm back from my travels. I think people know Rich and I were in Toronto last week for a couple of days, and it was fun, right, Rich?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your hat say?
What does my hat say? It says, I don't even know. Terry Black's barbecue. Oh man, when I went to Texas last year with my friends, we had barbecue in Texas. I love Texas, first of all. Amazing place. Lots of science, lots of oil. Two of my favorite things. And the barbecue was great too.
You say science? There's lots of science?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Just lots of science.
The JPL, the Jackson Propulsion Lab. There's Houston, which is where all of the NASA stuff is out of. They have major, major satellite manufacturing facilities there. They've got Texas A&M, which is an excellent school and big science. They have loads and loads of science, and then all the refining. I could go on, but I'll be quiet.
Man, only you would know that. Who's that?
And I'm wearing one of my favorite economists, Milton Friedman shirt. There you go.
So how would you, if you were like, you know, the NFL draft starts tonight. So yeah. If you're in the football world. So Rich, if you're doing your draft of, you know, favorite economists and central bankers, and you have the number one pick, is this your guy?
No, you're not going to like my answer.
I know who it is. So does Steve. Ready, Steve? We'll say it at the same time. 1, 2, 3. Carolyn Rogers.
No, shame on you. No, I'll give you my top. Shame on you. I'm sure she's lovely as an economist. But no, my top three are in this order. Are John Maynard Keynes, Milton Friedman, and Thomas Sowell. Those are my top three economists. There you go. With an honorable mention to John Galbraith.
Hey, speaking of merch, plug for the Looney Hour merch. Rich has been actually the mastermind behind getting the Looney Hours t-shirts, mugs up and running and shipped out the door. So yeah, if you want any Looney Hour merch, support the show. I mean, guys, basically, this basically just keeps the lights on. It keeps us from getting shut down. So not only do you have to put through, you know, we put you guys through the odd advertisement.
They are odd, aren't they?
Yeah.
I love the last one, Richard. I don't know if we can name the sponsor again, but the one with, you know, with the haircut. Yeah, the haircut utensil. Well, not hair. Well, yeah, it was. That was a good one, Rich.
Yeah, I could do better. I'm working on it.
Anyways, so that's what keeps the lights on. But anyways, guys, we appreciate it. So this week we've got very, very special guest, Sam Cooper. He's been blowing the doors open on, I mean, I would call it corruption, crime in Canada. You know, he wrote the book on, you know, Vancouver real estate, willful blindness, basically how, you know, illicit drugs are flowing through into money laundering, which is funneling into housing. And he's been really, Rich, I don't know how you explain it, but, you know, foreign interference in Canada, how JT knew about Chinese interference in the last 2019 election. And it's been widely reported now in the media, but he's been like the guy that's been pushing all of this out there and actually doing proper investigative work that is seemingly no longer done anywhere, including at the CBC. So We'll have him on shortly, but before we get to Sam, there's lots going on in the markets, Boomer. You've been keeping a close eye on it. We had some numbers out from in the US today. You want to walk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always keep talking about the trend and the path and journey and all that stuff. And, you know, we're not always right with a lot of things, but one of the paths that we suggest it could be happening is that growth is slowing, especially here in Canada, but inflation stays sticky. And this morning in the US, we had their Q1 GDP number came out. So the first time it came out for Q1. And on the face of it, it was less than what was expected. So that would generally mean, what's it mean, Rich? What are you going to do with rates? Cut or hike?
You're going to hike.
No, they would cut. Anyway, the number was softer, but then you looked underneath it. The inflation data point was a lot stronger. And one of the main reasons why the GDP number was a bit weaker than expected was because the domestic economy was so strong. So one of the key components in the GDP calculation is net exports. So if you're exporting more than you're importing, that's positive for your GDP. If you're importing more than your export, it's a negative number. So the American economy, you know, they export it less, but import it more. On that basis, it was negative. So this number came out today. Everything is pretty soft right now. But Steve, what's happening to the bond market? What's happening to it?
It's getting mullered.
It's getting mullered again. So I think, was it about a year ago, we were looking at, you know, where the 10-year could be. And back then, you know, we were suggesting, hey, it could get close to 5%. And back then, it was around 3.25%. Now, this morning, we're at 470, 472 right now in the 10-year. So this is a pretty big move. Rich, why don't you share with everyone the big movement that really took place after the number came out, like in the Fed funds market?
Oh, right. So we always talk about the warp function in Bloomberg, which is world interest rate futures or probability. And in that, they use different instruments, futures, Fed fund futures, OIS spreads, et cetera, to sort of calculate the probability distribution of interest rate expectations. So given the meeting, which will be in May, June, July, September, November, December, on and on, you can basically back out what the implied interest rate will be for a particular, well, I mean, in theory, you could do it for anything, but right now we do it for central banks. And that number is now basically saying there'll be no hike until December. And just to give you an idea.
Just to be clear here with the disclaimer, none of us here are experts in anything. We're three babbling turds. So that's
no,
it.
No. Sorry. What was it? Damn, I screwed up.
The first cut is no longer being expected until December.
Right.
And it, you know, and as few as like 4 months ago in December, the market was expecting about 150 basis points.
So 6 times 25 is 150, I hope. and so that's it. So it's an incredible sort of shift, incredible move. And I think not only is it the magnitude, but it's also the speed at which that's happened. And I think one more thing about the GDP, so related to the GDP print today, is something else that comes out with the GDP, which is the implicit price deflator, which I can never say without concentrating. And that's an important, to get nominal GDP, you have, you know, you, or to get real GDP, you sort of have your nominal GDP, and then the other component is the price component, right? So you got real GDP plus some kind of price bit, which is the IPD, implicit price deflator, equals your nominal GDP. And there's different ways to calculate it. We know there's CPI, there's PCE, personal consumption expenditure, and there's an implicit price index in there as well. And that was the other thing that I think freaked the market out a little bit. And we'll share the chart, which is that number jumped from 2.0 at the end of Q4 of last year to 3.7. sort of corroborating much of the inflation data that we've seen, whether it's services ex shelter or headline inflation, et cetera. And I think that's the other piece that I thought was interesting to point out related to the interest rate probabilities, which I screwed up.
So basically we have sort of GDP slowing, inflation kind of ticking higher. I mean, this is, again, kind of feels stagflationary.
Yeah, that's the big, you could describe it as the worst of both worlds, sort of in some way.
Keith, this is like everything that we've kind of been talking about though over the last month or two, which is, this is kind of like the worst scenario possible for Canada or the Canadian economy or the Bank of Canada for that matter, which is like U.S. economy kind of holds up, inflation remains elevated, sticky over there, and it doesn't give the breathing room for the Bank of Canada to actually meaningfully cut rates. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how much can the BOC actually cut if the Fed doesn't, now, right? Like, the market's saying, okay, the Fed's not going to move now till December. So what's the Bank of Canada going to do? I mean, like, they're going to get one, maybe two cuts realistically before they, you know, crush the currency and then import more inflation. So you're kind of in a rock, stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Well, you know, they could always use the strategy that most people use. They could hope that things turn out right. But what, let's just sort of reset this again, though. Overall, the American data continues to be okay, right? It's not, definitely not bad or horrible. It's not awesome or great. It's okay. So in some ways, they're achieving that soft landing they wanted from an economic perspective. But the challenge, of course, on the inflation side, inflation still remains strong. And this is a big problem, you know, with a capital B, you know, for the whole world. Because we also had the Canadian retail sales number that came out, I think it was yesterday. Today's Thursday. Yeah, so it would have been Wednesday, right? For right? And, you know, I know you do the, you want to go through the retail sales for Canada just to sort of set the stage for it, Rich?
Yeah.
Or no?
Here's my technical, here, sure, I'll give it to you. Womp, womp, womp. There you go. That's
okay. Canadian so the tire. First womp for January was up. The second womp for February was flat. And the third womp was like not awesome. So the reason we share it, because remember, you got to tie everything together. You can't just look in Canada in isolation or the Americans or whatever. But the Canadian retail sales number is basically flat for Q1. And this is a country with, you know, population growth is still going. Occasionally, our government likes to spend more money than they're collecting in taxes. So, but with two of those, you know, very stimulative measures happening, you know, retail sales a bit slow. So, you know, you compare that to the American story, things are pretty good. You know, this is setting up so that we, you know, the Bank of Canada will need a relief valve somewhere. And that's what you've been now hitting on, Steve, for a few weeks now. And I think you're going to be 100% correct with this. And why don't you just share with everyone what that valve is, Steve, the relief valve? Canadian dollar. Canadian dollar.
Yeah, the Canadian dollar is the release valve. I mean, yeah, I was chatting with, see, like a round table yesterday with, you know, a bunch of real estate guys, you know, lenders and bond traders. And so we, you know, we had a really good conversation over a couple pints. And one thing I'd like really emphasize, so the housing market's starting to turn again, right? Like as yields push higher, so your fixed rate mortgages in Canada have been pushing up once again. So all that sort of hopium around, you know, lower rates, you know, housing is going to take off, like that conversation is slowly fading out. So we're seeing the activity in the housing market start to soften again. But the big thing I'd emphasize is just when you really have these conversations, you look at like the chart on housing starts from CMHC.
That's such a crazy chart.
Yeah, but like they're kind of starting to roll over. They're kind of starting to roll over, but they're still really elevated. And you're like, wow, well, you know, it's not that bad. Sean Fraser is going to housing accelerator this. And then when you chat with like these lenders that are responsible for lending on like A, raw land, or B, like development sites for like construction financing, and they're all like, yeah, we're trying to get our money back. We're in private one-on-one meetings and we're ready to start breaking some kneecaps. Like the pig, it takes time for the pig to pass through the python, and like housing starts are going to get hammered in this country. It's like 100 basis points of rate cuts from the BOC in the next 6 months isn't going to save any of these developments. And so like it's taking time. Like a lot of these loans are, again, people are trying to get their money back. Funds are gating redemptions. And it's all, and you know, a lot of these developers are now going through the foreclosure litigation process, but that takes time, right? So like, I just see that and hear that from people that are on those front lines that are behind those loans and hearing the troubles and the concerns that they have. And you're like, this is only going to take time. It's going to take 12 months to show up in the CMHC data. But, you know, I think we'll be calling it the housing decelerator fund pretty soon.
So the one thing you just said that I heard it and I can't think of anything else here. The bankers are going to break kneecaps.
They're coming for you too, Burma.
My knees are a lot lower than the average person. So maybe they'll throw their back out trying to do it. Yeah, bankers can be aggressive, everyone. So be a bit mindful of them when we go into a recession. Mind you, Canada had never had a recession before, so people won't know how to react.
Well, you know, like I think, what is it? Like employment in the construction sector is what, 8 or 9% of the total labor force? I mean, it's, you know, again, if housing starts roll over, I think they're kind of starting to. But I think the trajectory to me feels pretty obvious. And so you have to think there's going to be just a lot less work going around in that sector over the next 24 months. But
and can you just talk about that chart that you shared on Twitter? Because I think that that's the one I was sort of referring to, which is the starts relative to
it was like
what we need.
People per housing unit started. And so, yeah, it just does not look good. I mean, granted, like, obviously population growth.
Yeah, but even if you normalize it, so that's like another fancy word that you use in the strategy business to account for massive outliers. But even if you normalize it, it's well below sort of what, a one or two standard deviations, right?
Yeah, it is. So, yikes. Yeah, like I said, I don't know. We'll see. I don't think, but I don't know. It's weird. Like, you had these... Yeah,
but an economy, you know, it's just a mistake that you guys are making. An economy is not about numbers. It's about people.
I thought you were serious for just one split second there. It's about both, I would say.
That's one of my favorite quotes of all time.
Yeah.
Remember when he says he doesn't think about monetary policy?
That was just fucking great.
Yeah.
Man, I think every Canadian is thinking about monetary policy these days.
As they should. But
I was chatting with one of my friends yesterday. He's a European-based manager. And, you know, we're just going through things. And he said, so what's happening in Canada? I said, well, this is sort of what we're set up for. And he said, I had no idea. I said, is anyone else talking about Canada? He said, no. Everyone's focused on, you know, China and the tech industry and treasury and the American election. He said, now it's interesting. So if we do start to roll in one direction or another, it will attract a lot of attention. But as of now, I think that's something that Ben Rabideau mentioned a few weeks back when he was chatting with us as well. You know, we're still not getting a lot of attention, but we'll see where we go now over this next quarter that's starting up, or the current quarter.
Well, if this kind of like plays out, Rich, I mean, it's probably another testament to the praise that Canadian oil should be getting, you know, that is arguably supporting that Canadian dollar, or will support the Canadian dollar probably more than it otherwise would.
Well, that's what's fascinating sort of, and the chart hopefully we'll share. I just popped it in the chat, which is the Canadian dollar used to be like move lockstep. Sorry, Canadian dollar relative to United US dollar used to be lockstep with oil prices, specifically WTI, which is the West Texas Intermediate. There's the Brent oil from Europe, but we look at the West Texas.
The Texas one has a lot more technology built into it, right?
Yeah.
Or science, different sorry. That's what you said earlier, right? There's more science in the Texas oil compared to the European oil.
Thank you for that invaluable contribution. So what's really fascinating is over the last 3 years, the Canadian dollar has not kept up with oil. So even if oil has risen back up to over 80, we've seen sort of the Canadian dollar decouple. And it tells me two things. One, it tells the real underlying weakness of our economy, sort of an indictment on productivity, weak retail sales, weak consumption, in my view, what we've been going through and what we will go through until the pig eats the python. Anyways,
pig passes through the python.
We're going through a balance sheet recession. I think that'll take a long time. That speaks to the weak productivity growth. Lots of those themes we've been discussing. But also, on the other hand, if we weren't one of the world's largest producers of oil, and we didn't sort of have that tailwind, or at least, you know, lifting us up, even as we sort of do everything in our power to, to destroy our economy, it is incredible, I think, what it means for us. Because when you compare the Canadian dollar, let's say, versus a basket of the yen, which is a little crazy right now, but let's say the pound or the euro, you know, there's still a really strong correlation there. And it's just really interesting what's going on. These volatility is always fascinating. I think it presents and exposes lots of different themes that we can talk about.
And that's where the, I know someone said, you know, we tend to talk a lot about the negative events that are coming up here in Canada, because that's where we are with the cycle. I mean, that's it. But one of the positive developments is that if we do, or I should say when, you know, when we do have this, you know, downturn that we're going to get, it will create a really great opportunity for foreign investors to come flying back into Canada.
Yeah.
As you said, Rich, because of the opportunity that's there with the energy world, the energy market, and so forth.
And resources and a bunch of other stuff. I think that's the thing. You're so right about the cycle. It's like, you're right. And you're right about, like, maybe we're emphasized too much on the negative. I mean, it's cyclical. And that's, we are in that part of the cycle. And sure enough, as the pig eats the python, we'll eventually be on the upswing. And I think there'll be loads and loads of interesting opportunities to talk about.
The python eats the pig. It's not the other way around.
Sorry.
Could you imagine? That'd be impressive.
It's like a honey badger. The honey badger, you know, ate the python. He survived. Yeah.
But without further ado, our good friend Sam Cooper joining the Looney Hour here. Let's jump over to Sam Cooper's interview right now. Sam Cooper, welcome to Looney Hour.
Thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you on. First and foremost, for those of you that are listening and you haven't read the book Willful Blindness, Sam's book, it's a tremendous read, specifically if you're here in Vancouver like I am. It really opens up your eyes to, you know, all the corruption that's happened. Obviously, you know, the massive runaway inflation and housing prices. It's a crazy book. Have you had a lot of political recognition on that, not only on Canada, but like in the U.S. as well?
Yeah, you know, it's a crazy book because Vancouver's a crazy town. And I found that out. And, you know, I do say that, you know, the book, surprisingly, it came in number one on Amazon in Canada, which blew me away as a launch. You know, that beat mine and everyone's expectations. And there was a real buzz. And I'll say this to you, Steve, you know, I would say that, let's just call the, you know, I have to argue with people now that I've gone alone that, you know, investigative reporting that I'm doing, it's got to be deep and it stands the test, right? The stuff I'm reporting, you know, if anyone can pick it apart, they will, because there's bad people and rich people I'm writing about. It stood the test of time. I would say that, you know, what I call, let's just call it, you know, the establishment media that's kind of unraveling, you know, as we speak. I'm not against, you know, these companies, but they couldn't, you know, they didn't have the capacity to do the reporting of that book. So it was a popular success in Canada. But as I think, as you know, a lot of, you know, people that find some success find, it was probably critically a lot more supported in capitals outside of Canada. Heavy hitters in Washington, D.C., people in, agencies, the U.S. State Department, the Pentagon called me up and wanted to talk about my findings. The government of Taiwan invited me over. So, yeah, like, I'm just blown away and so pleased that on a readability and a popularity level, Canadians loved it, a lot of them, and let's just call them, I'd say, people with integrity and a lot more power than anyone living in Canada liked it too. So that pleased me. not to diss anyone in Canada, but look, whether we get into this or not, I'm sorry, Canada just isn't picking up respect in capitals of the world these days, and it's because of the issues I outlined in the book.
White collar crime in Canada is actually encouraged, so
yeah. not by us.
It's incentivized by the government. Yeah.
Sam, so tell me about this. Like, you know, you mentioned like the media companies and things of that nature. You used to work for Global News. I'd imagine the stuff that you were reporting on was groundbreaking. It probably irritated a lot of big investment dollars, high up people. Did you kind of get like pushed out? Did you voluntarily leave? I'm just kind of curious how that played out. I know you're independent. You're on your own now, correct?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's sensitivities around this, but I can tell you, as I've told Terry Glavin, Jesse Brown and others, this is 100%, you know, my career choice and path. No one pushed me out. No one was displeased with my reporting. As people that have watched the Foreign Interference Commission have seen, the reporting is ironclad, factual. I tell people, some people may scoff at this, but I think this is the Woodward and Bernstein story of Canada. I started it. Others picked up on it. And so, yeah, what I did was I made a business decision to start my own media platform, The Bureau. And very specifically, it's so that I could continue, you know, the deep, rigorous and interesting reporting from Willful Blindness. And, you know, to your point, Steve, about, you know, probably ruffling corporate feathers. Look, that's something I write about in the book that started in Vancouver. I'll just come out today and say, look, people in Vancouver know who Bob Rennie is. People know who Ian Gillespie is. These are the condo kings that stand behind governments at levels. Let's just say, you know, okay, now Jody Wilson-Raybould has written that Justin Trudeau met her in Ian Gillespie's hotel. And in her words, she understood that he wanted her to lie. So I'm just connecting some dots. You know, the condo kings in Vancouver, we can call them industrialists that back governments. The point here is they wanted me fired, right? So this started with my uncovering of the money flowing into Vancouver. And then when I start to connect underground criminal networks internationally with China's influence operations in Canada, and you know, stories like how the China, you know, crime and what we call United Front Networks stole PPE masks from Canada in 2020, putting our people at risk. Okay, then that, of course, Steve, to your point, that causes a lot of sensitivities. And yes, I was targeted by, you know, a very orchestrated campaign of people working for bad people. And I do think that that's the type of reporting that does cause, you know, let's just call it nervousness at high executive levels. But I've made the decision that, you know, Canada probably errs towards the too polite, too politically correct side. And we just face issues that have to be tackled with sensitivity, but investigated head on. And that's what I do.
Hey, Sam, I think, you know, before we started, Rich shared his gratitude for all the work that you're doing, of course. And he did it in a very good way, a very soft way, which for the Looney Hour people, as Rich was, you know, he was showing a lot of love for you. But with this happening, you just hear that, you know, obviously a lot of different parties and groups were not being very nice to you. But was the opposite also happening, maybe within the government structure, either provincially or federal? Like, did you feel, hey, someone has my back with this? Or was it always just, you know, the little guy to say, hey, we appreciate your work?
I would say that... you know, I really recognized in migrating as a reporter from British Columbia to Ottawa, it was in my mind that for me to discover, you know, what was really and deeply behind, you know, money laundering networks that are ravaging cities like Vancouver, and for me to discover, you know, the foreign influence aspects behind that, I would have to go to Ottawa. And that journey would lead me into business networks in Montreal, Ottawa. And, you know, so I very obviously I'm ruffling the same feathers that Richard Fadden, you know, as your very astute listeners and watchers would know, he's the former CSIS director that stood up in 2010, I believe it was to Peter Mansbridge, CBC icon, at some academic conference and came out and said, hey, look, CSIS, we have deep concerns about some politicians in this country getting friendly with foreign governments. And, you know, we don't quite know how to deal with it. Very quickly, including in Vancouver, I believe a counselor named George Chow was one of the people that hit back at Richard Fadden. All kinds of big media columnists, you know, took shots at Fadden. The Ottawa structure literally, you know, brought him to heel. I believe pretty much, you know, let's just say, you know, showed him the door in Ottawa. He basically had to kowtow. And so, yeah, I have years later, that story continued. It got worse and deeper into Canada's critical institutions. And I got the same backlash, I believe, from a lot of the same people as Dick Fadden did. But being a journalist, you know, I can withstand that. And there's enough Canadians that understand this reporting is important. So, yeah, the little guy, they're not all little guys. There's a lot of very financially astute, you know, people in banks, hedge funds, law firms, people that support me, and readers that are paying subs for me to keep going. But I do think that, you know, certainly there's people in government that want me to keep going. I can tell you, I'm getting some of those messages, but there's also a deep leak hunt. There's a deep disruption that my reporting started rolling within Canada's political class and security institutions.
So Sam, within one more question. Yeah. Go ahead, so sorry. If we look at, you know, from the, you know, the Canadian government, like we always like to compare ourselves in the G7. Within the G7, how deep is the Canadian swamp? Is it deeper than the American swamp, or where would it rank amongst the G7?
Yeah, my point on this is that America has obviously very huge and, you know, watched around the world political divide problems, and yet they have institutions and so many proud, you know, just honorable professionals in, you know, the FBI, the CIA, in the US military, US State Department, across the board, you know, they have institutions. I always like to say, you know, if Martha Stewart can go to jail for a little stock jobbing, then you know you've got a real country, right? And as Steve said, on the other hand, in Canada, white collar crime is, you know, basically nudge, nudge, wink, wink, right? So the swamp, America's just a bigger play field for other states to get in there and try to mess them up, which is a big part of their political problems. But they've got swamp clears. They've got people that are pumping that out. And Canada, I'm sorry, we have good professionals, but they're politically controlled. The RCMP is not independent. CSIS is not independent. You know, it's very, very politically controlled. And that's our problem. Because imagine it this way. Say you're a foreign state that, you know, is pouring money into the industrialists of countries around the world, trying to, you know, what's called capture them and use the industrialists as sort of, let's just call them white gloves, as they would in Chinese culture, to control, you know, Canadian politicians. Beijing has been tremendously successful at that in Canada, more so than other G7 nations.
So can I just jump in there? Yeah, there's, Rich. I have a couple questions. So, I mean, just to give us maybe some background, people who may not know you, although I think they should get to know you as soon as possible, which is that, you know, you talked about, you sort of investigated the money laundering in China, sorry, Chinese money laundering around BC casinos. And now there's this foreign interference that you're getting into. And then there's the ArriveCan app, whatever. Why do you think there's such reluctance to prosecute corruption and white collar crime? To me, it seems like such an obvious and easy political win, like low hanging fruit, you know, to see Justin Trudeau frog march some big baddie in a suit for stealing money from the proletariat. Why do you think there's such reluctance to prosecute them? And how pervasive do you think? And I've got one more question after that.
I mean, I know, I let me put it this way. There's law firms and lawyers, you know, in cities in Canada that at this point are trying to watch everything I say. And, you know, for reasons, but I can tell you that good politicians in Canada say the corruption issues among politicians at all levels, so municipal, provincial, federal, would shock people. And the point beyond that is, you know, as I write in Willful Blindness, me as a Canadian, I was never, you know, I think I was taught that we're just such a straight-laced, law-abiding country. And beyond that, we have a cultural issue where I think we're pretty much conditioned to look at the United States and say, oh, they may be the biggest country, but they have so many problems. They're so corrupt. And I think we're wrong on that. You know, we have deep corruption problems, but as I say, we don't have the institutions to tackle sensitive political corruption cases. So I think we've got a systemic corruption problem, and that is that we don't have the institutions empowered to tackle corruption. And we've got, you know, a good old, you know, drain the swamp problem. There's a lot of corrupt politicians and corrupted by foreign governments, and it's only starting to bubble to the surface now.
So that's sort of follow up on that question, which is what you've basically articulated is that Canada's a soft target. And we know that the U.S. is serious about, for better or for worse, they're serious about expanding their empire, their military power, and their, you know, intelligence apparatus. And they know where the world is divided, which is, you know, what we're all going to basically deal with for the rest of our lives, which is Cold War II, China v. U.S. Everything else is a sideshow. Do you see pressure coming up from the South to get Canada to either expose some of this foreign interference, especially from China? And if not, why not? And do you see that changing?
Yeah, I'll tell you a few little anecdotes here. I mean, and they line up to what you're saying. So when I started to expose, you know, how transnational crime was so deep into BC casinos and real estate, and these are, you know, supposed to be regulated businesses that form the backbone of Western Canada's economy, I started to get, let's just call it, bumped by State Department officials in the region who wanted to talk to me and basically said, I even outlined this a little bit in Willful Blindness, they were like, you're on the right track. How big do you think the problem is? And we think it's very big. We think there's a deep concern with China getting, you know, a corruption economic footprint in Vancouver that's getting out of control. So that's 2017. That's when I know I've started to sort of hear from people south of the border that they have deep concerns about Canada. And, you know, I start hearing that, okay, yeah, you know, your government, let's say your government finally took a national security posture on, let's call it a Chinese satellite company that was allowed to buy, you know, a business in Canada. And we gave some information to Ottawa and said, maybe not a good idea, right? So that is happening behind closed doors. I don't even know if you'd call it, you know, just kind of a little bit of diplomatic pressure. And that's stepping up to the point where Canada is now shut out of sort of the high level security alliances. Wow. Right. So people, you know, there's something called AUKUS, and this is the United States, Australia, United Kingdom getting together on the highest level, you know, military intelligence and technology. And this will relate to exactly what you're talking about, whether it's a Cold War or almost a hot war, you know, in the Taiwan region, in the Indo-Pacific, Canada's not at the table. This gets back to Canadians have the image that we're the best friend of the United States, even if we look down our nose at them. It's not really the case anymore, right? We've become so complacent, and I would say systemically corrupt and corrupt among some of our leaders, unfortunately, that we're not trusted. And I'll end my answer here. I mean, after I wrote the book, a very senior, you know, U.S. State Department, the guy that led the proximate or probable causes the U.S. State Department was looking at, whether, you know, a lab leak or a natural cause for the COVID pandemic, this guy is, I'm talking about a person at a high level in the United States contacted me and said, I read your book and you discovered a lot. And I think the same thing. So I'm starting to hear from people in the US military and these, you know, people that know what's going on in the world saying you're on the right track. And, you know, they're basically in a polite way saying Canada's hooped. you're not going down the right road.
Can we unpack for those that are not familiar, you know, of what's going on with this foreign interference case? You know, you hear a little bit about it in the media, but like I said, I think most Canadians are probably just, you know, focused on watching the Maple Leafs in the playoffs and maybe aren't tuned in to actually what's happening. So can you kind of walk us through the story there, your revelations, and exactly kind of what's going on?
Yeah. So again, I wrote this book called Willful Blindness that, you know, revealed the narrative of how I discovered in British Columbia that Chinese organized crime was just such a powerful force and so intertwined into the real economy that it was, you know, shocking. And beyond that, you know, towards the end of the book, I get into my discovery that what we just call, you know, Chinese state actors. So Chinese security and intelligence, Chinese Communist Party entities are working, you know, directly with Chinese organized crime figures in Canada in something that's called the United Front. So this is a big revelation. You know, it blows some people's minds. There's even, you know, so-called, I would say, you know, the Georgia Strait published a 6,000 word article saying why the book is wrong. And I know that it's written by a guy that, you know, quite evidently is working for China. So that's another story. But what I'm saying is I ruffled a lot of feathers there. And by doing that, I demonstrated to people in the intelligence world that I understood exactly, you know, the means that China was using to interfere in Canada. No one was writing about, you know, election interference, you know, in 2021, 2022. No one had any idea. But these people start coming forward to me and it's like, you are writing about the United Front. You're writing about organized crime. These are the entities that interfered in Canada's 2019 and 2021 election. There's clandestine funding of candidates. This is being run out of the consulates, you know, in Toronto and Vancouver. There's real estate developers that are acting as, I'm giving you a little scoop here. There's real estate developers that are acting as proxies for Chinese intelligence to fund certain candidates. So it's just tying into everything I was looking at financially in Vancouver. Now, intelligence sources are saying this is the channel by which China is interfering. And, you know, the punchline or the sick joke here is that for decades, Canada's government has done little or nothing about this kind of thing. While CSIS, you know, our CIA, for your American listeners, was warning, you know, government after government. But it just got worse when Prime Minister Trudeau was elected. And I just published a story today on the Bureau saying that CSIS reported in June 2019 that Beijing was calibrating its support for Justin Trudeau and the Liberals to show displeasure in the Meng Wanzhou detention in Vancouver. So this is a new story. It's just revelations that, you know, some of them I broke the news as these sources came, starting at Global in November 2022. You know, the Globe and Mail picked up on some stories in the way that they do. And this led to the inquiry. And again, I'll finalize my answer by saying the real story here is that the sources are saying the Liberal government of Trudeau is basically seen like a co-conspirator. look, a National Post columnist picked up on that point that, you know, my stories have, you know, written, I would say, in a more measured way. A National Post columnist last week, after hearing Trudeau's testimony in the foreign interference inquiry, wrote that his senior national security source believed the Trudeau Liberals are co-conspirators with Beijing, because they have not responded to CSIS's many intelligence warnings. So that's a mouthful, but clandestine cash, supporting candidates in order to, for them, you know, to secretly, you know, support Beijing's policy, gathering intelligence from political staff of candidates, attacking other candidates, especially out in BC. You know, your viewers will know probably about the story of Kenny Chu, who's just deeply smeared in the Richmond riding for his, you know, political stance. And it hasn't really come out, but the evidence is very clear to me, and I've written a little bit about this, that the media entities that attack Kenny Chu turn around on a dime and support his liberal opponent in Richmond. And that hasn't really come out in the Foreign Interference Commission hearings, but, you know, a lot of pretty interesting evidence has come out.
Can you give us a couple examples of ways that they would also like influence the election or influence certain political candidates to get more votes? Like, what are some examples of that?
What should we be looking for next year?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you should be packing up and looking to move to another country if we don't get a good result out of this commission, because you know, documents that came out in the commission said, again, Trudeau's government was warned after the 2021 election that China's proxies were emboldened by the success they had in 2021, right? And again, nothing has been done in response to that, which again is the nut of the story, right? The Liberals appear to have benefited from Chinese interference, while their opponents, most clearly the Conservatives, are attacked. So, Steve, you ask, you know, what are the actual methods? I gotta say, there's a little information gap between what my sources understand and know and couldn't share with me, I believe, because of the sensitivity. So, but I do know that, as I've said, I reported in 2019, there was a clandestine transfer of $250,000 directed from the Toronto consulate into an election interference network of candidates supported in the Toronto area. And, you know, the methods of transaction I reported on included what's called a community leader in Vancouver, who's associated to, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds, but is associated to one of these so-called United Front groups, the type of person that, you know, we have video of them shaking hands with Xi Jinping in 2019. And as I say, you know, in podcasts, it's like a money laundering transaction flow where, for plausible deniability, you know, the consulate wants a result. Quite evidently, they want to influence the Mun Wanzhou case, which I didn't report before, but I've reported today. And so money flows into the election system to support things like media reporting for candidates that Beijing favors. And I can't get into too much detail, but that's what has come out in evidence. And so I can say it with confidence. But other things would be, I reported that these Chinese interference networks, which include consulate officials, community leaders who are not really community leaders, I'm saying they're really gangsters, political candidates and their campaign staff are part of this Beijing election interference network. And so, you know, candidates from different parties could be supported. It's not always the Liberals that are supported, but it's very complex. And I just to simplify it, sometimes candidates are supported, sometimes they're attacked. Media funding, that's a big part of it. Campaign volunteers. And, you know, I think there are probably bigger and more clear cases of how money flows into certain political leadership candidates' campaigns. But I don't quite want to, and I shouldn't really get into, you know, that before reporting it.
Can I ask one more? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just have one more from my side. Thank you, Sam. So with all this now coming to light and increasingly more people becoming aware of it, which is good, has there been any proactive measures or anything coming from the Canadian side, you know, towards, you know, this network or group to say, hey, this has to stop? Or is it just gets you know, it loses its energy and people lose interest over time and don't care about it. Like, which direction are we headed towards?
Well, with no question, you know, and I've written this on my platform, we wouldn't have a Foreign Interference Commission today without the reporting that I started at Global News, the reporting I continue at the Bureau, and the Globe and Mail, whether I like all of their reporting or not. Clearly, they've done significant reporting as well. So this caused the commission that has surfaced all of this evidence of, you know, it's not a question anymore. The government knew China clandestinely interfered in 2019 and 2021. That's not disputable. So there, and, you know, without getting into the weeds, there's just a lot of solid evidence that came up in this public hearing, which means that, you know, there were, I would say, great political forces prior to the commission were still trying to argue that Canada didn't have serious problems. They can't do that anymore. So I believe that will lead to some new laws that will make, I've said the RCMP and CSIS are not independent and they're toothless. After the commission, the commissioner, Hogue, a Quebec judge, will have the chance to recommend what laws could be instituted. But before we get there, the complexity is, you know, the commission is proving what I reported, and that is that for years, it has been recommended to Justin Trudeau that you need to institute these laws, such as, you know, a foreign agent registry or criminal code amendments to go after foreign interference, which is a different thing than espionage, really. And Trudeau's done nothing. That's just indisputable, right? This is what I reported. This is what angered people. So to your question, you know, will the energy dissipate? I don't think at this point it's possible. I think we'll see new laws. Will we see accountability of the politicians involved? I doubt it, but that's up to the public. That's up to the public voters, I would say. And I'll tell you this, I moderated a panel just 2 weeks ago with the Honorable Tony Abbott. He's the former Prime Minister of Australia. You know, he had a front row seat on similar interference from China. And he said, in his words, you know, I won't try to mimic his accent, but he said, clearly Canada is a bit wobbly on foreign interference, but kudos to your country for surfacing a lot of this evidence in the commission, which will also be helpful to the international community.
So Sam, just following up on that, you know, I'm reminded of the Russia Trump collusion thing. Russia colluded with Trump, Russia colluded with Trump, on and on and on we went. I'm less interested in whether or not that's true and more sort of how it was covered by the CBC. And boy, was it covered by the CBC. I mean, if you just Google Russia Trump, there is a litany. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles written. The same cannot be said of China Trudeau. China colluded with Trudeau. Trudeau. Can you explain to me, like I'm a child, why the CBC refuses to do anything about it? Am I wrong in that assessment? Am I too biased? Or is it just a lack of, you know, journalistic integrity? Are they captured? Like, what is going on there? Because those two, to me, is a, are there a facsimile? It's an obvious comparable. And yet the treatment that our, you know, country's news broadcaster, it's wildly different.
Yeah, no, you're completely on the mark. And there's a few things going on. I mean, the first thing would be it gets back to, you know, what I would say is kind of our elitist conditioning or attitude in Canada, that it's always, you know, the big bad guy to the south that has the problems, and there's no bigger or badder guy in the Canadian mind, and especially in, you know, the elite, you know, tea rooms of Toronto or wherever you have it, that we're just the biggest, baddest person to personify, you know, these Canadian attitudes about the states would be Donald Trump. And so the CBC, you know, of course, you're exactly right. It's a different country. And, you know, they just spent so much time and energy throwing what I call red meat to their audience, who wants to read about the big bad guy. And I'm not saying he's not a big bad guy, but it's just like, okay, you're mandated to cover Canada, spend a little energy, as you say, on our own issues. But I do think, and I've started to become public about that. Yeah, I do think there's people in CBC that are deeply captured. It doesn't take a big stretch of imagination, you know, to see that obviously that the conservative opposition, a lot of them quite loudly, you know, say let's defund the CBC or the CBC needs to be smaller or, you know.
But let me jump in there. See, that's, but to me, it, you know, it's the chicken or the egg. If the CBC grew a pair and went after Justin Trudeau and the, as you say, demonstrably true interference by a foreign actor who we ostensibly do not approve of their political apparatus, the defunding the CBC would ring hollow. And so that's why I find super fascinating about that. So sorry for interrupting, but I just need to jump in there.
I agree with you. I mean, I like, there's a part of me that feels uncomfortable that now I'm in the position of being an independent journalist and saying, you know, I can actually speak now. I remember one of my colleagues that I really like. He's just a really hard-ass investigative reporter. He blocked pretty much all CBC reporters on Twitter or X because he was so pissed off that they always copied his stories, right? Like, they've got such funding. They have really such power to cover Canada. And yet, you know, they'll just like copy paste the work of other reporters. And I don't want to give the impression that it's the whole CBC. I think there's a lot of good journalists there. I just want to be very clear about that. I like a lot of CBC journalists. There's a lot of good journalists, but there's also, I would say, and I've seen this for years, there's a really strange culture that obviously, you know, it's very close to the government in some ways. And if the Liberal government isn't in power, then that media entity is obviously endangered, you know, point blank. But it's not just the CBC. Like, I mean, I don't want to get into American politics too much, but I knew right away when I read stories about Joe Biden's son that the names I was reading on the China side, you know, this was adding up, right? But it's only the New York Post that was writing about it. And I'm like, if the facts are the facts, you know, don't let your political leanings get in the way of the evidence and the truth, because very clearly Chinese intelligence will try to cultivate anyone. They don't care if you're, same with the Russians, right? You know, they're very sophisticated. So you just gotta, I guess the way to end this answer is, yeah, CBC's got some deep problems and they're not helping themselves by letting their partisanship or their weak journalism, you know, a significant part of their company is getting in the way of the good journalists that they do, you know, employ.
What would you do if you were in charge of the CBC? Would you take the job, first of all? And what would you do if you were in charge?
Yeah, maybe one day they'll want me to take the job. You know, I think that the CBC is an important entity.
So do I.
I haven't put deep thought into this, but the thought I've put is, you know, I used to be a real huge CBC reporter, and, you know, people that were this side of me politically would like hammer me for that. But over the years, I've come to recognize they have some deep problems. So just as a Canadian, I think, you know, we should be keeping that entity. So we've got coverage, you know, in the places where we need it, but the politicization of their managers and some very senior reporters. Yeah. If you hire me as a consultant, those people,
what would you do?
They'll be gone. They'll be fired. They'll be fired and reprimanded.
Hey, Sam, I wanted to ask you, you know, I know you've written about it. Is the drug or fentanyl problem, you know, particularly where I am here in BC, it just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. Yeah. And there's a lot of people pointing fingers about, you know, who's to blame. And so what have you found through your findings about what's going on there?
No, that's a huge one. Like, that is the one that drives me. That is the one that kept me awake at night, because, you know, this is one thing where, just like, as almost a junior reporter, and I write about this in Willful Blindness, I'm just seeing the amount of real estate money pouring in from other countries, the drug problems, and they had to be related. And as I got more, you know, sourced up and more, let's just say, skilled in my investigative capacity, I was finding that, yeah, that it looks very like that the Chinese regime is supportive of, you know, these people that are, we know, flooding Western Canada with fentanyl, right? So is that, you know, clearly it's a deep corruption problem on the China side. Is it a strategic corruption problem where it's not just, you know, a lot of Chinese officials that are, you know, getting bribes from worldwide, the biggest fentanyl traffickers in the world? Is it a fact that Chinese officials are in fact leading those gangs? Yes. And not only doing it for profit, doing it for strategic reasons.
Also,
and,
yes.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, in my book, I raised that and, you know, again, got a lot of backlash, but it was I believe it was a strong circumstantial case. And it's very important for Vancouver because this, you know, points to the major problems of the city and its future. And, you know, I'll just say that again, last week for the Bureau, I was the first in the world, I believe, to cover this U.S. Congressional Committee hearing, which said William Barr, two-time Attorney General, now retired, came out and said that this committee of the Congress came up with compelling evidence that the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese state was facilitating global fentanyl trafficking and doing it, you know, through subsidies. So they're basically, they were saying, we have evidence that if you're a transnational mafia, as long as you're selling fentanyl abroad and not inside China, we're subsidizing you. We're paying you for it, right? I don't know. I don't call it confirmation bias, but when I get evidence that the circumstantial case I was piecing together is true and how damaging that is to the world, it's just, I'm the type of mind where I never stop being shocked, right? I don't understand how people living in Vancouver can get that knowledge and, you know, just be watching the Canucks or the Leafs and not be, you know, hammering on the table and you know, petitioning their politicians. So that's that. I mean, this is a problem for the world. And I believe the U.S. government is about to get very serious about this. You know, the issues to focus on BC. Yeah, you can't safe supply your way out of this. You cannot, you know, you're not going to fix this by decriminalizing fentanyl. These may be well-intentioned ideas, but in my mind, the volume of fentanyl coming in from China, the money it's generating, the corruption, it's such a big problem. It'll snowball and get worse and worse. So if the government is, you know, paying for a little safe supply here and there, it's only making the problem worse. It's just it's a pure volume problem. And now we've heard, you know, the evidence is coming out, although it looks like the BC politicians don't want it to, that the RCMP says, yeah, this safe supply is now defrauded it's being defrauded into crime networks. And as I say, it's just increasing the volume of opioids. And now it's getting easier for kids to get it. So, Steve, this could be a very long answer, but I think, like, you know, I'm very proud of the story that I did for the Bureau, which kind of got back into my financial wheelhouse, showing that HSBC has been basically giving away fraudulent loans to these very same underground Chinese transnational crime and real estate fraud and money laundering networks. And it's at a scale that will blow your mind in Toronto and Vancouver. Steve, you know, everyone was always looking at these real estate titles and saying, okay, in Dunbar, here's a acclaimed scientist, an acclaimed housewife with a $15 million mansion. It's like, how many scientists from China are moving over to Vancouver and using their funds? And where are their funds coming from? It was pure bullshit, right? But now it's provably bullshit that our big banks were like writing these loans. And I'm saying, that is underwriting the fentanyl that's coming into BC and money that's going down to Mexico and just cycling around the world.
Yeah, it's a lot of funny money. And, you know, I'm sure we can't talk about it on the air, but, you know, some of these glitzy high rises in Vancouver that definitely makes you scratch your head a little bit. But Keith, Rich, I don't know if you had any final questions for Sam here before we let him go, but this has been super enlightening, infuriating.
I think this is probably one of our most important interviews yet, Sam, that we're really looking forward to share with our network. So thank you for your time today. It is a very important conversation.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you, Sam, and ask you my last question is, where can people stay abreast of all your amazing work? And yeah, that was it. Just thank you. That's all I wanted. That was my last question.
Yeah, no, this has been a great chat with all three of you. I'd love to come back and do it again. And people can go to thebureau.news. That's where I'm writing my investigative reports on a weekly basis. I'm going to call it Canada's best independent investigative platform. I'm claiming that. And you can also follow me on Twitter, where people in BC, you know my handle since 2009 at Scooper Cooper. So those are the two main vehicles. And yeah, you know, I'll post when I do podcasts with you or anyone else on the Twitter channel as well.
Sam, the bureau.news, is it like a Substack, right?
Yeah, it's platformed on Substack, which is working for me in the launch period. But actually, I have a custom built website, which I'm ready to roll out and wield, you know, as I grow potentially. But for now, Substack is working. I'm getting, you know, good network effect and a good, it'll be up to 10,000 subscribers soon. And I'll steadily, you know, try to monetize and convert them all into paying subscribers and and hopefully, you know, hire some more journalists and build. What I want to do is build a network of like-minded journalists that can use that platform.
Hey, good for you. I think that's exactly what we need, especially in today's day and age where these tools are readily available. And we need these independent voices. And obviously, that's kind of what we're doing here. So, you know, our hats are off to you. And like I said, appreciate you coming on the show and taking your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was a terrific interview there with Sam. Just, I don't know, really eye-opening. I just feel like there's so many people. I mean, certainly not our audience, but I feel like there's a huge swath of Canadians that are just so naive as to how the world actually works and moves and operates.
That's a fair point, Steve. I come across that quite a bit. And, you know, I love the good intention that everyone has. And unfortunately, as you begin to see underneath a few layers, you realize, man, it's pretty disgusting, no matter where you are in the world. You know, you can easily see how people can sort of turn and say, oh, man, everything is horrible. But I think, though, the challenge with Canadians is that you don't have to turn one way or the other, but you need simply to be aware of what's really happening and not just read one or two news medias that you read all the time. And I thought this was a very important conversation. I think people need to be aware in Canada that, you know, I think we referenced the swamp earlier during the conversation with Sam. And, you know, we wanted to do that for a reason because the swamp is real. It really is. And but swamp, the way to the
swamp
diffuse
runs
it,
deep.
It runs deep, but the more you're aware of it, at least then you won't take everything, you know, verbatim for what you're hearing and reading and stuff. Because again, everything is not clean cut.
Yeah, I think I love that saying. It's like, you know, people are told what to think, you know, and not taught how to think. Right?
It's totally, like, totally.
And I think that is a huge, unfortunately, a huge chunk of Canadians, which is just read article, accept it for what it is, don't ask questions, carry on with your day. And, you know, this is what you get. You just get this complacency. And yeah, it's unfortunate to sort of see, you know, a lot of what's going on. But
well, so that's why that was my thing. I mean, yeah, I would consider myself one of those naive people, really, until I started following Sam and really paying attention to the work that he's done, and especially as an independent, I think, and imagine the heat that he gets. I mean, But the thing for me is, like, I think the complacency, Canada needs to stop being complacent. And I don't just mean from the political corruption standpoint. I don't just mean from the military stuff. I don't just mean from productivity. I think it's all of it. Like, this idea that our shit don't stink, that, well, because we don't have, you know, the social ills of America, that somehow we're holier than thou. I think that that's that. I think that that, you know, that that's no longer true. You know, call me Red Pill Rick. You know, I don't know. I think it, like, I think it's really important that people sort of recognize that not only are there huge problems. Again, let's, I want to stress the opportunity. Canada is an amazing country. And we do have the potential and the opportunity to pull ourselves out. But I will just say, I'm going to beat you to it, Steve. I normally never recommend the podcast on the podcast, but I would say this is the one time you'll probably hear me say, I think you should share this one with, listen, like, your friends and family and colleagues, because not, and maybe it's because we didn't talk that much, but mostly because I think Sam has a real message to put out there, and I think it benefits us all in the end. I don't know, Steve, if you agree or not, but
like, share, subscribe, buy a t-shirt. It's all we ask. Boomer, you got any final words? Final words here?
No, not on that. I, you know, as we continue to say, and, you know, I think we're having success with this podcast as well. As long as increasingly more people are having these conversations, that's what matters. And have it in a very calm and rational voice. You know, you don't need to get, you know, Trump derangement syndrome or Canada derangement syndrome. It's, hey, be open-minded here. But the more people talk about it and you realize, hey, you know, there's a lot of bad actors out there always trying to take advantage of this system, which means it's money out of your pocket, I mean, at the end of the day. And, you know, the fentanyl story in Vancouver, you can clearly see how all that is linked together. And it is just shocking that, you know, there's not a great solution that's coming out for any of these problems. And I suspect, you know, the foreign interference in inquiry, I think that's what it's called.
Circus. I think it's called the circuit.
You know, maybe I'm just, you know, I don't have a lot of confidence, but, you know, nothing's going to happen with it. And at the end of the day, you know, like, personally, you know, you can throw things at me. You know, we don't live in a democracy. You know, I didn't vote for the prime minister, and I can't vote for the leader of the other party either. You know, you're voting, it's for a representative, someone to represent you in a space. So, you know, we have some big challenges coming up in the West, you know, including Europe as well. But, you know, again, as long as we keep talking about it and follow the loony hour, maybe you'll be better off.
There you go. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. As always, guys, appreciate the support, and we'll see you next week.